You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It ain't Friday, but Friday we're going to be off in Portland visiting our kids and family, my mother-in-law and brother-in-law and whatnot. So we're doing brunch with Bernie today, in fact, right now. So get your questions ready for Senator Bernie Sanders. Our national town hall meeting begins now with Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you.
Happy Thanksgiving to all of the listeners.
Indeed. So what's on your mind, sir?
We have been focusing of late on this whole issue of the fiscal cliff and deficit reduction. And the issue here is that the American people have got to stand up and stand up really strong to take on the big money interests in Washington. And what the American people have got to say is, you know what? The middle class and working families are already experiencing a whole lot of austerity. Unemployment is very, very high. Wages have gone down. People are having a hard time paying their bills, paying for health insurance. And as we go forward toward deficit reduction, it has got to be the people on top, the top 2% who are doing phenomenally well and who are now paying a low effective tax rate. It has got to be the large corporations, profitable corporations, one quarter of which, Tom, pay nothing in taxes. It has got to be the Defense Department right now, which is bloated and which can be cut. That is the direction in which we have got to go if we're serious about doing deficit reduction in a way that is fair. Now, what troubles me very much is right now you have virtually all of the Republicans standing there saying, we've got to cut Social Security. We've got to cut Medicare. We've got to cut Medicaid. We have to cut education. And that's the only way we can do deficit reduction. And meanwhile, they continue to defend extending Bush's tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country for another 10 years. That's $1 trillion that we can save. They want to continue the absurdity of having the United States government lose about $100 billion a year because corporations and wealthy people are stashing their money in the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, and other tax havens. So what we are looking at right now is a very fundamental and significant issue. Do we balance the budget and move toward deficit reduction in a way that is fair, which asks the people on top who are doing very, very well, large corporations that are doing very, very well, to start paying their fair share of taxes, or do we really attack programs that millions and millions of people desperately depend upon, especially in the midst of this terrible, terrible recession? So that's an issue that I've been working very hard on. Second of all, I worry very much, Tom, about a recent report that didn't get quite the attention that it deserved to get, I think, dealing with the warming of the planet. Mm-hmm. And what this report done by some of the leading scientists in the world suggests, that if we continue going our merry old way with fossil fuels and greenhouse gas emissions, we may be looking in the year 2100, not that far away from here, at a planet which is some 8 degrees warmer than it is today, 8 degrees warmer. And if that happens, what these scientists are telling us is that we're going to have more severe Hurricane Sandys. They're going to occur more often. We're going to have more drought. We are going to have more flooding, and it is really very questionable what this planet will look like if we don't get our act together. So we are working on legislation right now which will make it, which will allow us to go forward in a very significant way to cut greenhouse gas emissions, move away from fossil fuels, move to energy efficiency, move to sustainable energy. And by the way, when you do all of those things, you're going to create a whole lot of jobs in this country. And when we talk about what's going on in Washington, and a whole lot of discussion takes place on deficit reduction, which is an important issue, no question, we cannot forget that as we speak, some 23 million Americans are either unemployed or underemployed. We cannot forget that millions and millions of our neighbors are working longer hours for lower wages. Median family income has gone down significantly in the last 10 years. People are struggling. So I know that everyone's focused in the media on deficit reduction. Well, I think we should also focus on the need to create the millions of jobs that this economy desperately needs. And we can do that most significantly, not only by transforming our energy system, but also by rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, roads, bridges, airports, water systems, wastewater plants, rail. And when you do that, you not only create jobs, you make our country more productive and more internationally competitive. So we cannot lose track of the job crisis in the United States of America. Of immediate concern, you and I have talked about this in the past, is the status of the Postal Service. And I know we have a lot of folks who listen to this program who are concerned about the Postal Service. We've heard a lot of questions that people have. We did a pretty good job in the Senate in fending off some of the disastrous cuts that the Postmaster General wanted to implement, which would have been half of the postal processing plants in America and some 15,000 rural post offices. But I'm afraid our Republican friends are now beginning to negotiate with some Democrats, and we're going to intervene on that issue because I want to do everything I can to protect the Postal Service, not see massive layoffs there and a lower quality of service for the American people. So those are some of the issues, Tom, that are on my agenda as we head into the lame duck session and in a month and a half into the new session.
Bernie, it was basically on Ronald Reagan's watch that we stopped maintaining our infrastructure. You know, he moved trillions of dollars into Star Wars and the military-industrial complex. The Republicans control the House of Representatives. Any thoughts on how the agenda that you just laid out can get through that?
Well, I'll tell you, Tom, and that is really the $64 question. We'll have better luck in the Senate, and as I think many listeners know, that as a result of this election on November 6th, Democrats actually won two more seats in the Senate, including some pretty progressive people. We're looking forward to seeing Elizabeth Warren now in the Senate, Tammy Baldwin, Mazie Hirono, and others, new members coming into the Senate who are going to be quite progressive. What I think in terms of dealing with the Republicans in the House who have lost a few seats there and maybe have a little bit woken up a little bit to understanding that the American people are not supportive of right-wing extremist agendas, I think the way to deal with that is not sitting for hours in long negotiations in Capitol Hill. I think that the president, members of the Senate, members of the House have got to get out to the American people. Because, Tom, the position of the Republicans, this right-wing extremist position of more tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires, ignoring the reality of global warming, continued attacks against women in the gay community, those are not items, those are not ideas that are resonating with the American people. And the way you beat them, frankly, is when millions of people, and I hope people who are listening to this show, get on the telephone and they call up their congressperson or they call up their senator and say, excuse me, you're not going to cut Social Security, you're not going to cut Medicare, and you're not going to cut Medicaid. You're going to have to ask your campaign donors to start paying a little bit more in taxes. But unless we rally the American people, we're going to have some tough sledding.
I solidly agree. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders, taking your calls and answering your questions. Back with more.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website. I got his newsletter alert this morning with the news break. You can do it all over at sanders.senate.gov. Sign up.
Well, we're living here in Alex Hall. And they're closing all the factories out in Bethlehem, they're filling time. Filling up forms, standing alive.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders. It's on Tuesday. You're not listening to a repeat show. Today is today is Tuesday before Thanksgiving, and Thanksgiving holidays are messing with everybody's schedule. So Bernie has graciously agreed to be on today. Rodney in Chicago Heights, Illinois, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. God bless you, sir. And my question is, I know you had to resolve, but does the Democratic caucus have to resolve to protect Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security?
Well, Rodney, thank you for asking that question. And that is a question that is very, very much on my mind. And I can tell you there are some members who certainly do have the courage and the determination. There are some, I fear, who do not. And we have got to make all of the Democrats and all of the Republicans an offer they can't refuse. And that is stop protecting the wealthy and large corporations at the expense of working families. You know, when you talk about deficit reduction, there are a couple of issues that have to be raised. Number one, how did we get to where we are today? And the answer is pretty clear. To a significant degree, Bush and his friends, including some of these great deficit hawks, went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. They didn't pay for that war. Bush and his friends gave huge tax breaks to the wealthy people, didn't offset it. Passed Medicare Part D prescription drugs, didn't pay for it. And then because of the greed and recklessness and illegal behavior on Wall Street, we were driven into this terrible, terrible recession in which so many people continue to hurt today. But among other things, a lot less revenue comes in to the federal government because of a recession. That's why we are in the deficit situation we're in today. And given that reality and given the reality that we have a totally unequal distribution of wealth and income in America, where the people on top are doing phenomenally well, while the middle class and working class of this country are really hurting, common sense and decency suggest that you do ask the people on top to pay some more in taxes. You know, some people say, well, we need to spread the pain. No, I don't agree with that. You don't throw children off of health insurance or take nutrition programs away from senior citizens and say, well, that's the same as asking a millionaire or a billionaire to pay more in taxes. It is not the same. Many of these people on top have made huge amounts of money in recent years. As Warren Buffett reminds us, their effective tax rates are quite low today. So it is not, you know, equal balance here. You got one group of people, i.e. the middle class and working families, low-income people, they are really hurting. They've been hurting for a while, and they're hurting a lot more because of this Wall Street recession. And you got another group of people doing phenomenally well. Well, who should help us with deficit reduction? And on top of all of that, because, as Rodney just indicated, the Democrats negotiated quite weakly and poorly in the last two negotiations, budget negotiations, 2010, 2011. You know what happened? Rich didn't pay a nickel more in taxes. In fact, we lowered taxes on the estate tax. Meanwhile, we cut over $900 billion over a 10-year period on programs that will impact ordinary people and children and sick people. So to my mind, Rodney, we have got to buck up every member of the Democratic caucus, and people have got to put pressure on them. Tom, I don't know if you noticed it, but some of the unions now, quite appropriately, are beginning to advertise in states where they think that some of the Democrats might be willing make unwise compromises,
yep,
cave in. And I think that's the right thing to do. So we have to buck up all of the Democrats. We have to tell the president that this time, not 2010, it's not 2011, he just won a major election. This time he has got to be tough and tell the wealthiest people in this country, you know what, they have to undergo a bit of austerity. It cannot only be working families who are struggling to pay the bills, pay the lights, take care of health care, send their kids to college. We need a little bit of equity in this country, and the people on top are going to have to pay a little bit more in taxes.
Roger in St. Cloud, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders, for taking my call, and thank you, Mr. Thompson, for what you do. I have a suggestion that all these big Walmarts, it's about the environment, and giant warehouses that take up ungodly amounts of property, why don't we make them all put solar panels on the roof to offset the electricity that they use during the day that would help cut back on coal burning and fossil fuel burning.
Roger, I think that is a great idea. I think that's a great idea. The good news is that we have seen an explosion in the use of solar in the United States. The cost of solar panels has plummeted, and we've got to continue to do that. And if my memory is correct, Roger, actually Walmart in some places is actually doing that. But I think many of these warehouses which have these, which are occupying a whole lot of space, I think it would make enormous amount of sense for them to start putting solar panels on their rooftops.
Bernie, just a minute to the break, a real quick question. The Germans backstop mortgages for people who want to borrow money to put solar panels on their roofs, and then they require the power companies to pay a surcharge that more than covers the cost of the mortgage for the 7 or 10 years of the mortgage. And so there's no government money. There's ultimately no bank money. The banks make a small profit on it. Everybody wins, and Germany has replaced basically the need for 20 nukes. Could we do that in the United States?
Well, we sure could. I mean, I don't know if that's the best plan forward, but there is no question that in a variety of ways, Tom, we can move this country forward towards sustainable energy. And by the way, we want to see those solar panels manufactured here in the United States, putting our people to work rather than in China. But that's certainly a good idea, and there are other ideas out there to accomplish the same goal.
Okay. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour on Tuesday, special on Tuesday. So give us a call for Senator Sanders, 866-987-THOM, although all the lines are busy right now. But when one becomes available, that's the number. We'll be right back with more of Senator Bernie Sanders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for his newsletter, and also you can sign his amendment to the Constitution. Welcome back to our Brunch with Bernie hour on Tuesday this week. And Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Al in Warner Robins, Georgia, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Senator, thank you for talking to me. I did down my phone. I'm on the speakerphone. But my question, I guess, is the Republican Party now, the way that they've performed in this election, I think they're going to be irrelevant in the next, for sure in the next 8 years, if not the next 4 years. Now, and my question was, you know, what do you think about that? I think the Democrat Party is going to be the new center party, and a new, more progressive party will develop as an opposition party. And I think the GOP is going to be marginalized unless they do something to change their stance on abortion and birth control. What are your opinions about that? Thank you, and I'll listen.
Well, thanks very much, Al, for that thoughtful question. And you may be right. I don't know that anyone can make that prediction. I could tell you here in my state of Vermont, just more and more people, including folks who used to be Republicans, look at the Republican Party today and they're saying, wow, what century do these guys live in? Attacks against women's rights that women have struggled for decades, they want to repeal. Their anti-science attitude, I think Marco Rubio was hard-pressed, the senator from Florida, the other day to acknowledge what every scientist in the world knows, that the Earth is somewhat more than 6,000 years old. Their continued defense of billionaires against the needs of working families. I think that is just not a set of principles that resonates with the American people, especially younger people. Now, you raise another issue, and that is, and you're quite right, you refer to the Democratic Party as a centrist party. And you're right, it is. Within the Democratic Party, and I speak as an independent, you have some really strong progressives, but you also have some folks who aren't that far away from being Republicans. And then you raise the question is, if you have an extreme right-wing party and you have a centrist party, there's a huge political gap out there in terms of millions and millions of working families, environmentalists, women who really want somebody to be strong, to take on corporate America, to have the guts to move aggressively with regard to global warming. And it may well be, Al, that you're right, that in that gap will come a progressive-type third party. Here in Vermont, we do have a third party, which has some, I think, 3 out of 30 senators in our state senate, and that's the number of people in the House. So that may very well happen. My hope is, though, that in the short term, people will put as much pressure as they can on the Democrats, who just want a huge victory, and say to the president and the Democratic leadership, you know, get rid of your dependence on big money, start standing up for working families, and we can beat the Republicans big time. We can win this deficit reduction fiscal cliff battle, and we can win a number of other important fights as well.
John in Highbridge, New Jersey. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Tom, how are you today? Thanks for having me on. What I wanted to ask was, now we've got Grover Norquist and the rest of these Republicans on the run, and I was wondering, Senator, if you thought it was too soon to really sort of put the stake in the heart of the beast and start forming the Sanders-Warren 2016 campaign and let them know they're in real trouble.
I would donate.
Well, thanks very much, John. I very much look forward to working with Elizabeth Warren. I've known Elizabeth for a number of years. She came to Vermont 3 or 4 years ago to do some town meetings with me. I tried to help her a little bit in the campaign. So we look forward to having her join the Senate and being a very, very strong voice for working families against the abuse that Wall Street, among other institutions, has been rendering the American people. But I think right now we look forward to serving in the Senate and let 2016 take care of itself.
Vi in Donovan, if I'm pronouncing that right, Missouri. You're on the air with Senator
That's
Sanders.
Correct. Good afternoon, Senator. It's truly an honor. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, Senator, what about reforming the filibuster? That is such a... We cannot let things go back to the way they were with this filibuster business. And I'll take my answer off the air, Senator. Happy Thanksgiving, all.
Well, thank you very much, Vi, and happy Thanksgiving to you, and thanks for your question. And Vi is exactly correct. I've only been in the Senate one term, 6 years. But what I do know is that historically, the Senate has kind of operated to a large degree on good faith, on kind of, you know, a handshake and gentleman's agreement and all that stuff. That's been broken. It's been broken since Barack Obama has been in the White House. It was broken when Mitch McConnell, who is the Republican leader in the Senate, made it very clear that his top priority was to defeat Obama, make him a one-term president. It was broken when you have hundreds of filibusters requiring 60 votes, when you have all kinds of obstructionism, all kinds of holds, making it incredibly difficult to get judges appointed, even when they came out of the Judiciary Committee with almost unanimous agreement. It was very clear. Anybody who objectively looks at what's happened in the Senate since Barack Obama has been president understands absolutely a major pattern of obstructionism. And Vi is right. We need to do something about it. So what I would tell you that a number of us, Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon, Tom Udall of New Mexico, and others, and I, are looking at various options. You will know what happens quite literally on the first day that the Senate comes back into business, because that is the day you have to determine the rules of the Senate, and that is the day that we are going to go forward with filibuster reform. Can we get the 51 votes that we need? I certainly hope that we can, and some folks are working pretty hard to make that happen. But, and there are a variety of ideas out there about what filibuster reform means. But bottom line is, you just cannot have a minority running the United States Senate and obstructing what the majority want.
Jim in Las Vegas, Nevada, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Jim?
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air, Jim.
Yeah. Tom and Senator, sorry. My parents and other educated elderly people that I know seem to be convinced that when they turn when Obamacare or Affordable Care Act goes into effect, that they will lose their Medicare. Is that true? That cannot be true, is it?
No, it is not true. Period. It is not true. There were no cuts to the benefits in Medicare as a result of Obamacare. What was done and what should be done, and Jim, it's important for all of us to understand this. Not only is the United States the only nation in the industrialized world that does not guarantee health care to all people as a right, but equally important, we are the nation that spends far, far more per person on health care than does any other nation, almost twice as much. So what some of us want to do is make Medicare and Medicaid more efficient, get the profiteering out of it, get the bureaucracy out of it, improve electronic records and other mechanisms that make the system more efficient. But Obamacare, tell your mom, Jim, Obamacare did not cut one penny in benefits for seniors.
Okay. Jim, in Indian Head, Pennsylvania, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Jim, you're on the air with Bernie. Jim's not there. Okay. Peter, in New York, New York, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Senator. Good afternoon, Mr. Hartman. Senator, what do you think of letting the Bush tax cuts expire? Then have it suggested to the public that they pay current taxes or new taxes at the old current rate, and promise them that when they elect a Democratic Congress in, with both houses majority, including more than 60 senators from the party, they'd be given a tax forgiveness and amnesty by the president and the Democratic Congress. Is that legal? Is it feasible?
Well,
is it desirable?
I think it's legal, but I don't know how feasible it is, and it's a bit complicated. And one of the things about politics, Peter, you don't want to get too complicated. What I do think is we have got to be very aggressive this time. The Democrats have got to tell the Republicans, sorry, yes, we caved in 2010, we caved in 2011, we ain't caving in right now. And right now it is your friends, the millionaires and the billionaires and the large corporations, who are going to have to start paying your fair share rather than just working families. Now, if that agreement cannot be reached, Peter, as you know, what happens is all of Bush's tax breaks expire for the wealthy and for the middle class. If that happens, if an agreement cannot be reached, and that happens, what will happen, I am 100% confident, is that in the next session, certainly in the Senate, what we will do first week back for sure is pass legislation to restore those tax breaks to the middle class. And by definition, forcing the upper income people to people making more than $250,000 to pay at the old rates, over 39%.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, 3 days early here on Tuesday. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders in our national town hall meeting. Brunch with Bernie.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You can drop into our live chat room at TomHartman.com. You can visit Bernie's website at Sanders.Senate.gov. Sign up for his newsletter.
Tom Hartman.
Well handled, sir. Well handled.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour on Tuesday. David in, is it Kanoa'i, Hawaii?
Kaneohe, Hawaii.
Thank you, Hawaii.
Aloha.
You're on the air with, aloha, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Okay. Well, for the Democrats to take back the House in 2014, maybe it would help to attack the Republicans, and especially the Tea Partiers, on one of their main strengths, which is they present themselves as defenders of the free market. So how about if Democrats become the party of the true free market? And that means no externalizing of costs like pollution, no socializing of losses, no subsidies to oil companies, no monopolies or cartels. COE pay is tied to their true value instead of what their cronies on the board give them. It means information is freely available to everyone, so no inside trading in the House of Representatives, et cetera.
Well, David, thank you very much for that excellent question. And I'll give you an example of something, picking up on David's point, and I hope everybody understands what he means by externalizing, of course. For example, you can make the case that producing electricity from coal is relatively cheap. That's true. But when you say that, you're ignoring the fact that those carbon emissions are wreaking havoc on the planet and causing illness, which have enormous costs, which included in the cost equation, do not make coal all that expensive. I will tell you, nuclear power, another example. Right now, there is federal legislation which says that if, God forbid, in this country, we ever have a Japanese-style nuclear meltdown, it will be the taxpayers, after the nuclear industry pays a certain amount of the damage, it is the taxpayers who are going to pay the rest of the costs, because there's no insurance company or Wall Street company that would provide insurance for nuclear power because it is so risky. And if they had to go to the private sector and not the taxpayers of this country to get the insurance they would need if, God forbid, there was ever a $100 billion disaster in America, nuclear power would not be quite so inexpensive either. So David makes a very profound point that when you look at the cost of something, it is more complicated than the price tag. You got to look at the damage that the product may be causing in terms of our environment or in terms of our health. Mm. So that's a great question, David. Thank you.
Okay. And Manuel in Grays Lake, Illinois, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, is this going to be the year that you and Senator Sherrod Brown start pushing back hard against free trade and reactivate our American policy of tariffs so we can revitalize manufacturing? Because without this wealth creation of manufacturing, the $2 trillion or so we're going to need for infrastructure is never going to happen.
Manuel, you make a great point, and I can't speak for Sherrod Brown. Sherrod is a great senator from Ohio. He and I have worked on this issue together for a very long time. We worked on it when we were in the House. We're working on it now in the Senate. You are not going to have a strong economy and a strong middle class when Americans go to the stores and every product they make, or most of the products they make, are made in China or elsewhere. So Manuel is exactly right. We have to rebuild our manufacturing sector. We have to demand that corporate America invest in this country, creates jobs in this country, that we produce products in this country, and that is an issue that is very important to both Sherrod Brown and myself. And, yes, we're going to work as hard as we can to move in that direction. The opposition, by the way, Manuel, will be just enormously powerful. You got all of the Chamber of Commerce, all the big money guys who like the idea of being able to shut down in America and go abroad, hire people at low wages and bring their products back into America. But in my view, our trade policy has failed. We've lost over 50,000 factories in the last 10 years. Wages have gone down. So we need to rebuild our manufacturing sector, and we've got to work with people all over this country to make that happen.
Elda in West Hurley, New York. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, you're my favorite person and speaker for the country. I wanted to bring you back to Obamacare. Basically, I'm just wondering why Obamacare isn't regulating the amounts of money that doctors and hospitals and insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies get paid. I mean, pharmaceutical companies make so much money off of their business because they advertise these very dangerous drugs on TV. Doctors totally cost unbelievable amounts of money, and the insurance companies are in the middle there playing that game. So if you have insurance, it's a free world. Go to this specialist, go to that specialist.
Elda, we have just a little less than 2 minutes left in the hour. So
well,
can we toss this to Bernie now to answer?
Elda asks a great question, and the answer is what Elda is really talking about is the need for the United States to do what other countries, every other major country, has done and pass a national health care program. A, guaranteeing health care to all people as a right, and B, once you do that, you can control costs in a way that you can't with our largely dysfunctional system. In terms of the pharmaceutical industry, Elder, let me tell you something you may not, you know, want to hear, but it's certainly true, is that I think in order to get Obamacare passed, the Democrats made a deal with the drug companies so that we really have not been able to bring forward the kind of pharmaceutical industry reform that we need. What everybody should be aware of is in the United States, we pay by far the highest prices in the world for brand name prescription drugs. That's just the simple fact. When I was in the House, I took a number of people from Vermont over the Canadian border, and they were just shocked that they were able to purchase the same product, the same drug, a breast cancer drug manufactured in America. They bought it for one-tenth the price in Canada. So we have got a lot of work on our hands to make create a healthcare system guaranteeing healthcare to all and do it in a cost-effective way, including lowering drug prices.
Senator Sanders, thanks so much. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us this week.
All right. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
Thanks. And you too, and your family. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. And Senator Sherrod Brown, one of the best guys in the United States Senate, just won re-election over a right-wing crazy who outspent him by gazillions. And I think it's a real testimonial to decency and truth triumphing over dirty money. But those are my words. I'm curious to get Senator Brown's take on this and on where we're at as a nation and where we're going. So, Senator Sherrod Brown, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back. I hear all those problems in those election day registration states where there's all this fraud. So,
yeah.
I think Scott Walker's right about that, don't you?
Yeah, right. I think there's, is it six or seven states, it's in that neighborhood, that allow same-day registration?
North Dakota doesn't have any registration.
That's right.
States, you know, this was this year. I mean, I know how you love to put things in historical context, and I just turned 60 a few days after the election, and I've watched this stuff a long time, and this was the most cynical effort in American politics in my lifetime, where on the one hand, they spent, you know, the hundreds of millions nationally. In my race, it was $40 million in outside attack ads, NRA, coal companies, just oil companies, Carrove, all that. And then on the other end, they tried voter suppression. And the only way they win is by depressing turnout, suppressing the vote to depressing turnout, and buying elections on the other end. And, you know, it really is this. We have seen Republican efforts to suppress the vote, but never have we seen it from the top down, in state, from governor's offices and state legislatures and state after state after state after state. And it was just how it was so cynical, and it's morally reprehensible. I mean, it's beyond differences in policy. It's a moral question, and they're on the wrong side on this.
Well, and frankly, shouldn't it be a legal question? The Constitution mentions the right to vote several times, although it's always narrowly framed. It's in the amendments, you know, that women shall not be denied the right to vote. You shall not be denied the 13th Amendment based on previous condition of servitude, in other words, having been a slave. But there, according to Bush v. Gore, there is no affirmative right to vote that encompasses everybody. Is it time to pass a law or even amend the Constitution to make that so that you know, people like Scott Walker and Rick Scott and whatnot can't mess with your right to vote?
Well, you missed the part of the Constitution that says Democrats shall not be allowed to vote in these states.
Right.
I'm not a lawyer, and I'm certainly not a constitutional lawyer, but it's clearly going in the wrong direction. And I don't know, maybe that's the way to a more affirmative right to vote. But it's really stunning because I, you know, the you look at what happened on civil rights in the 40s and particularly in the 50s and 60s in terms of changing laws, and we've only moved in one direction in this country, and that's embracing people's right to vote and in enlarging the electorate, whether it was people of proper without property or women or African Americans, and now we're moving the direction in some states of restricting it, and we have not seen that at least in the last 100 years or last 50 years, and that's what's troubling about this. Maybe it needs to be something more affirmative in the Constitution, but something to be sure, because the voters, I know it in places in Ohio, in low-income areas, in middle-income, working-class areas, the lines were longer. And some people said that's a bit of a poll tax, but if you got to get home and take your kid to choir, prepare dinner, or do whatever working-class parents have to do each day, and you see a line that's going to be 45 minutes at the polls, you just think, or you see those signs in inner city Cleveland about, voting fraud is a felony. And you think, you're out of prison, you've paid, done your time, and you think, never mind, it's not worth that chance. That's real voter suppression, and it's about civil rights and it's about human rights.
Yeah, well said. The fiscal cliff is getting all the PR right now. It's kind of sucking up all the air in the room. There are a lot of other topics, but I'm curious your take on where we're at as a nation facing, on the one hand, these terrible deficits that really started under Reagan, and on the other hand, facing this dramatic loss of good manufacturing jobs that, again, started under Reagan, but have really picked up steam over the last 30 years. What kind of problem is this country really facing, and what do we need to be doing?
Well,
what should our priorities?
It's clearly a jobs deficit, a middle class jobs deficit. I mean, not to in any way belittle or underestimate the importance of the budget deficit, but in the 1990s, when the president made some budget cuts in a fairly balanced way and increased taxes mostly for upper income people, we had real job growth, and that's why we got to the largest budget surplus in American history. We've lost manufacturing jobs for basically almost every month between 2000 and 2010. We've seen manufacturing job growth almost every month since. It's not significant enough. It's important, but it's not vigorous enough or strong enough. But it's clear that whatever we do in this fiscal cliff, and it may more, some people have termed it more of a fiscal curb stepping off it, is that as government looks to cut and increase taxes or whatever we do, it's got to, first of all, sort of pass this create jobs test. And what else do we do to create jobs? And it's investing in infrastructure. It's investing in communities so there aren't teacher layoffs and firefighter layoffs and all of that, because we've generally gone somewhat in the right direction the last couple of years, but not fast enough.
And apropos of that, when we came out of World War II, our national debt was 127% of GDP, much higher than it is now. You'd have to inflation adjust the dollars and all that kind of stuff. But as a percentage of GDP, it was worse than it is now. And then the Korean War even added to that. And so Republican President Dwight Eisenhower paid down that debt. How? By massively investing in government manufacturing projects. As Jack Kennedy pointed out in 1960, 80% of the cost of all new hospitals built in the 50s, in the decade of the 50s, was picked up by the federal government. It's just massive spending, the Eisenhower Highway Program. This was a Republican president. Why are the Republicans unwilling to even talk about in these kinds of investments that clearly create jobs, and then those jobs create taxpayers who pay down the debt?
Exactly right. Well, and you can think of a couple of huge things that happened in the 40s and 50s where government invested, in one case, highways, and started this whole, build a foundation of economic growth beyond just the construction of the highways, which was massively expensive, mostly picked up by the federal government. The other one started in 1944 and then accelerated in the 40s and 50s, and that was the GI Bill, where the government understood you help millions of individual GIs at the same time, which is a good thing. At the same time, it raises the level of prosperity for society as a whole. And that's what's missing now. I mean, we don't do either of those very well. And it clearly, both of those set the foundation for prosperous times. I mean, look at, and you not to argue for this, but you look at what the tax rate, Eisenhower did not, I believe he did not even reduce the tax rate.
No, it was 91% throughout his term, and he defended it.
Yeah, and he defended it. And not very many people paid that amount because it was the very rich in those days that did. But that money, so much of that money was being, you invest in infrastructure, invest in people, which is another kind of infrastructure in a sense, and economic growth grows you out of that deficit. And that's what happened in the 90s. It's what happened in the 50s and
yeah.
40s going into the 50s. And they don't want to learn from that. And I'm not exactly sure why they don't.
Yeah. I don't, I never hear a Republican on TV or conservative, they're always, we need to cut this or, cut that, but they never say grow our way out of it. I've never heard that phrase come out of their mouths.
Yeah, I think that's right. They don't say it, and I mean, partly they may not want to go back to discussing the, if they do that, discussing the difference in economic policies between the Bush years and the Clinton years. And we don't like to go back in this country, but we also should learn from the distant past and the recent past, and those were two good examples, the Clinton versus Bush years and the Eisenhower years.
Yeah, very, very well said. Senator Sherrod Brown, thanks for dropping by, and congratulations on your reelection, sir.
Speaking out every day.
And people can check out Senator Brown's website at sherrodbrown.com and brown.senate.gov. Thank you, sir. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour, rich people complain that the fiscal deal cliff could force them to pay slightly higher taxes, reports the Senate from American Progress.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. Every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent.
Yes. Well, Anonymous is the apparently the secret agent in this case. We'll see. As laid out yesterday and the day before, in various rants here on this program, Anonymous, Karl Rove, the 2012 election fix, all that stuff. It's possible that Karl Rove used SmartTex servers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, to flip the vote totals in Ohio in 2004 and thus steal the election that year for George W. Bush. And it's just as possible that he tried to do the same thing this year on Mitt Romney's behalf, but was thwarted by the hacktivist group Anonymous. Many people have responded to these claims with a variation on, come on, that's impossible. A presidential candidate committing treason, that never happened. And if it did, it'd be front page news. Everybody know about it, right? Wrong. Consider some simple history. First Republican president in my lifetime was Dwight Eisenhower. And there's not a hint of scandal associated with his election in 1952. Maybe that's because he supported a 91% top marginal income tax rate on the rich. He approved of very popular New Deal programs like Social Security and unemployment benefits. As he wrote to his brother in 1954, should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear of that party again in our political history. There's a tiny splinter group, of course, that believes you can do these things, a few other Texas oil millionaires and an occasional politician or businessman from other areas. Their number is negligible, and they are stupid. End of quote from President of the United States Dwight Eisenhower, 1954, while he was president. But Eisenhower, in my opinion, was the last legitimately elected Republican president. Pardon my sneezes. Richard Nixon, who won the 1968 election against Vice President Hubert Humphrey, followed Eisenhower. At that time, the Vietnam War was raging, millions of students were in the streets, and President Lyndon Johnson, throughout 1968, was working desperately to bring a negotiated end to that war. He'd gotten both the North and the South Vietnamese to agree to terms of peace, and by late September, there was only a meeting in Paris to seal the deal. And then the CIA brought LBJ a wiretap they'd intercepted between the Nixon for President campaign and the office of the President of South Vietnam, Nguyen Van Thieu. Nixon basically told them that if they refused to go to the peace talks, or at least refused to go along with the peace agreement that LBJ had worked out with them, then Nixon would give them a much better deal after the election. LBJ was bat guano furious. I mean, this was treason. And because he could listen to the actual CIA phone intercepts, He knew that Richard Nixon was at the heart of it. So he called the senior Republican in the United States Senate, Everett Dirksen, one of the most honorable men to hold a Senate leadership position in generations, particularly among Republicans, and told him what was going on. Here's what he said.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico. And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
Yeah. Everett Dirksen, the fabled, storied Republican leader. This is treason. Yes, I know. LBJ continued with this.
And I'm calling you only after talking to Rusk and Clifford and all of them who thought that somebody ought to be notified as to what's happening. Now, I can identify them because I know who's doing this. I don't want to identify it. I think it would shock America if a principal candidate was playing with a source like this on a matter this important.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
But if they're going to put this kind of stuff out, they ought to know that that we know what they're doing. I know who they're talking to, and I know what they're saying.
Now, Everett Dirksen promised to contact Nixon personally and try to put a stop to it. But in later conversations reported back to LBJ, Dirksen reported back to LBJ that Nixon wouldn't even discuss it with him. General Tu dug in his heels. The war continued. Humphrey lost. Nixon won the election. This is a historical fact. So why doesn't every American know that Nixon committed treason in 68 to win the presidency? Remember that conversation with Dirksen where LBJ said, I don't want to let this get into the campaign, that America would be shocked? He didn't want the American people to learn that one of the two candidates for president was a traitor. He was afraid it would so horrify and dishearten the American people that they'd lose faith in the American democratic system. In fact, we didn't even hear these tapes until just a few years ago when they were finally made public by the LBJ Library, and even then, they were largely ignored by the national press. LBJ went to his grave with this secret, as did Hubert Humphrey and the entire CIA team that outed Nixon. The American people were not to know that the Republican candidate who became president was a traitor. The next Republican to run was Ronald Reagan, along with CIA Director George H.W. Bush. At that time in 1980, the Shah of Iran had been stricken with cancer and left Iran for the U.S. for treatment. And Islamists had taken over the country, along with taking over our embassy and holding its occupants hostage. And Barbara Honegger, who has been on this program, she worked in the Reagan State Department. She wrote a book about that time called October Surprise. She and reporter Gary Sick, who also wrote a book of the same title, both reported that during the week of October 15th through the 20th, Reagan campaign director Bill Casey went to Paris and met with representatives of the Ayatollah, asking him to stop negotiating with Carter and just hold the hostages until after the election. If Iran would do this, Casey promised, we'd get them weapons for the U.S.-supplied military that the Shah had amassed, and he'd route those weapons. Casey would route those weapons through Israel so no one would ever know. The Iranians said yes. And the next day, on October 21st, the Iranians inexplicably, at least the Carter administration, that thought it had worked out a deal, stopped negotiating. The world later learned that over the next 3 days, Israel began, now this is before the election even, over the next 3 days, Israel began shipping F-4 fighter jet tires to Iran, the first of many shipments of U.S.-made weapons to go that route over the next few years. I'll tell you the rest of this story right after this break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Is it possible that the last Republican who was sworn in as President of the United States without fraud or treason was Dwight Eisenhower?
I'm afraid that it's the one thing.
Welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, we were talking about the Shah of Iran had been deposed, the Islamists had taken over, the Ayatollah and his students who had occupied the U.S. embassy and were holding the people in the embassy hostage. And Bill Casey goes over and cuts a deal with them in the middle of October saying, just hold them until the end of the election. So actually, they held them until January 20th. And literally at the exact minute that Reagan raised his hand to be sworn in, the Iranians released their hostages. It was their way of saying, deal done. When we found out about it and that the money the Iranians were paying Reagan for the military hardware was being used to kill Contra rebels in Nicaragua, it was referred to as the Iran-Contra scandal. Remember that? But Congress, concerned that the details both of the weapons and of Israel's involvement with the Bush campaign before the election might come out, even though now that's a matter of public record, Congress limited its investigation to events after the election. On November 22, 1991, 11 years after that election and after Reagan was long gone from the White House, Gary Sick was called to testify for a congressional hearing on intelligence and security. And there he exhaustively detailed where his reporting had led him and how Reagan and his team had committed treason. He said, quote, "What this evidence shows is a consistent pattern of secret contacts between the Reagan-Bush campaign and Iran. The contacts began early in 1980, from about the moment that William Casey became the campaign manager for Mr. Reagan. They continued through the summer of that year in Madrid, where the first outline of a deal was reportedly proposed and accepted, and where Israeli participation was first introduced." End of quote. Sick then continued in his testimony, quote, "The terms of the bargain were reportedly made final in the second half of October in Paris. The hostages were released minutes after President Reagan had taken the oath of office, and arms began to flow to Iran from Israel with U.S. government acquiescence almost immediately thereafter." Also in the testimony, Sick points out curious remarks made by the Iranian foreign minister to his parliament on August 16th of 1980. He said, quote, "We have information that the American Republican Party, in order to win in the upcoming election, is trying very hard to delay the resolution of the hostage question until after the American election." This is what the Iranian foreign minister said, according to Sick's congressional testimony. Sick points out that statement was made only a few days after Casey was reported to have met with an Iranian representative in Madrid for the very purpose described in that statement. End of quote. Now, we didn't learn about Casey and Reagan's treason until years later. Ronald Reagan went to his grave with a secret, as did his campaign manager, who he had made head of the CIA, Bill Casey. Perhaps for the same reason that LBJ told Everett Dirksen in 68 he wouldn't out Nixon as a traitor, because it would shock America. Perhaps for that same reason, the American people were kept in the dark this time, too, about the Reagan candidacy being treasonous. The next Republican running for president in a serious way was George W. Bush, and his brother, who was governor of Florida, knew that the only way George could win was if tens of thousands of Democratic voters were purged from the rolls. So Jeb Bush ordered his Secretary of State, Katherine Harris, to purge tens of thousands of largely African-American voters from the rolls, which she did. Harris kicked nearly 60,000, mostly African-American voters, off the rolls, claiming that these people, who comprise 3% of the entire African-American electorate in Florida, had been convicted of felonies and therefore couldn't vote. Turns out, though, that was mostly a lie. The list, based on a Texas felon list, led to tens of thousands of completely eligible African-American Florida voters, with names similar to Texas felons being denied the right to vote. So thanks to Republicans throwing all these mostly Democratic-leaning voters off the voter rolls, the election stayed close enough in Florida to for its outcome to be in doubt after election night. The Florida Supreme Court ordered a statewide recount of the vote. George W. Bush sued at the Supreme Court in the infamous Bush versus Gore case, claiming that if the entire state was recounted, it would, quote, create irreparable harm to complainant George W. Bush. Yes, that was what they charged. So the Supreme Court gave the presidency to Bush. And it wasn't until a year later, in November 2001, that a group of newspapers completed their count of the Florida ballots. And when the New York Times reported it, they buried in the 17th paragraph of the story the bombshell that had the Supreme Court not intervened and had all the ballots been counted in Florida like the Florida Supreme Court had ordered, Al Gore would have won no matter how you counted the ballots. As the Times reported, quote, "If all the ballots had been reviewed under any of seven single standards and combined with the results of an examination of overvotes, Mr. Gore would have won by a very narrow margin." End of quote. Why was that line in the story buried? Well, the Times and the other news publications didn't want to delegitimize Bush just a month after 9/11. But the fact remained, he hadn't won the election. Al Gore did. Al Gore still won't talk about it. just like John Kerry. He's only spoken to one reporter on the 2004 election issue. The American people are not to know that the Republican candidate, George W. Bush, and his brother Jeb were traitors. So here we have all the Republican administrations in the last half of the 20 and 20 and early 21st centuries. Nixon, Reagan, Bush, and Bush. And every one of them took the White House by fraud and or treason, to quote President Lyndon Johnson. And now we have questions about Karl Rove trying to electronically rig the election in 2012 in three states. And Democrats and very rational liberals are saying, oh, there couldn't be a conspiracy here. Everybody would know about it. The press would report on it. There's no way you could get away with that. You're being a conspiracy nut. Well, just look at the Republican history of the past 50 years. As LBJ told Everett Dirksen, this is treason. Why is it that the Democrats are so afraid to talk about this? I don't get it. Okay, Mike in Maplewood, New Jersey. It says here, Tom's conspiracies are outrageous. Really?
The two most despised presidents, Reagan and Nixon, this was not reported by the press who hated them so much, and I wonder why.
Well, Lyndon Johnson did not reveal this. I mean, LBJ, I mean, you've heard the tapes, right? There's no disputing what happened. And LBJ did not reveal that he knew this to anybody. I mean, basically, other than his national security team, the CIA knew about it. And, his vice president, and that was it. He kept it a secret. He went to his grave with it because he didn't want the American people to think that a guy could work his way all the way up to being the Republican candidate for president of the United States and be a crook, be a traitor. And this is the reason why Democrats won't talk about the insecurity of electronic voting machines and why they get all hysterical, particularly the Democratic establishment, when anybody does talk about it and say, oh, you're being a conspiracy nut and, you know, that kind of stuff. Because they're afraid that if Democrats think that the system is rigged or that the candidates are traitors, or at least all the Republican candidates have been since Eisenhower, not including Eisenhower, that they won't vote. And I think history proves them wrong. I think history demonstrates the opposite case. I think history demonstrates that when people know what's going on, they're more likely to turn out. And the proof of that, in my mind, is in this election, voter suppression efforts by the Republicans were really quite obvious. I mean, there was just all this stuff going on, all these very obvious voter suppression efforts. And it directed mostly at African-Americans. What did African Americans do? They turned out in record numbers because they were saying, "You going to try and take away my vote? No, I'm not going to go along with that. You steal a million votes, we're going to show up with 5 million." So I think the American people can handle the truth, and I think that we are entitled to the truth, Mike. Harold in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Harold, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I heard this topic. Was it yesterday?
Yeah.
Henry Kissinger. Nixon's foreign policy consultant.
Right.
He was the one that told Nixon that if he could sabotage the Paris peace talks, that basically he would win the election. It was Henry Kissinger.
Do you have any evidence of that?
Behind this. So that's why.
I mean, it's fairly clear that it was Bill Casey who carried this out, In her book, October Surprise, Barbara Honegger documents how Bill Casey told his lawyer, Milton Gould, that he was going to testify before Congress fully and completely on the issue when the Iran-Contra hearings were happening. And that morning that he was supposed to testify, he had a seizure in his office as the director of the CIA. He was taken to Walter Reed or to Bethesda or whatever the hospital is, a naval hospital, and the left parietal lobe of his brain, Broca's region, was removed, the part that controls speech. His tongue was cut out, and then he died ultimately a few weeks later from the surgery. But so we know, Casey played a role in it. But do you have any evidence that Kissinger suggested it, or is this speculation, Harold? Harold?
Yeah.
Do you have any evidence of this, of Kissinger proposing this, or is this just your speculation?
No, no, it's not my speculation. I have been following Free Speech TV for 10, 12 years now. There have been various documentaries out on this. And if you were to go to Wikipedia, a 1968 presidential election, it would indicate, the word is rumors, but it would indicate that...
Kissinger came up with the idea. Harold, we're out of time, but thank you very much for the call. That's an interesting one. Now, it's been some years since I saw the movie The Crimes or the Trial of Henry Kissinger. I wonder if that's in there. It's been some time since I saw it, so I frankly don't remember. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if Kissinger came up with the idea.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, Kissinger was certainly behind in the election of 72, Nixon suggesting that there was a secret plan to end the war and that he was the peace candidate, unless he got reelected.
I read the news today.
The news. Our Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's most recent political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at free-don.org. Check it out. And our new Talk Radio News Service reporter, Ellen Ratner, right here in the studio.
Let's talk a little bit about Mideast because it's become very, very complex. Hillary Clinton went over to the Palestinian Authority today in the West Bank. She's on her way to Egypt. She's either there or on her way. And then she's going to go to see Mr. Netanyahu. But the issue is, the problem is with Hamas. Now, technically and legally, it is with the Palestinian Authority, but that is not who controls the area of Gaza. And she's not going to Gaza, now probably for good reason in terms of her safety.
Right. Anderson Cooper almost got whacked.
Right. But, however, the question is who she's talking to. And that's where things get complex. Also, the Palestinians say that they want an end to the blockade. But then if they do that, then who sort of traces the arms deals? And the other word on the street is, are they willing to negotiate because they're running out of arms? But that doesn't mean they're going to, you know, that doesn't mean that things are going to be fair over there. And, you know, I know from when my cousin Aaron David Miller was the Mideast peace negotiator, he's been on the air all the time, and he wrote that book, The Much Too Promised Land, and also wrote that article in the Washington Post a while back that said that America has to be an honest broker in all of this. But I know that things are so complex over there. It even deals with things like water rights.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't think of that as a major issue, but over there they do.
Oh, yeah.
And so... you know, Hillary Clinton is over there trying to negotiate this, and it's so interesting because this is at the end of her sort of 4 years, as
her
we
tenure.
Know it, her tenure. And President Clinton, he was so interested in the Middle East that he used to know every settlement, how many people were there, who was controlling it, et cetera.
Wow.
So it'll be very interesting to see how much backdoor diplomacy he's really involved in this as well.
What would be very interesting also would be to see if after Hillary leaves her position as Secretary of State, if she becomes an ambassador without portfolio and tries to help resolve this kind of through back channels in a very low profile way and then pulls a rabbit out of the hat a year or two down the road. Boy, would that help her presidential prospects.
Yes. And listen. I covered the Clinton for 8 years and the White House. I always used to say, what did the Clintons say when they left the White House? Well, what is it, Alan? We'll be back.
Really? Yeah.
Yes. And I don't think most of America would mind at this point.
No, I would vote for Hillary in a heartbeat.
Right. Yes, exactly. Okay. Some other things going on. As you know, we're looking at Black Friday, and it's increasingly looking like Black Thursday, unfortunately, because people are opening up. And as you know, some of the unions are having real objections to stores being open on Thanksgiving. I'm one of these people that thinks it's dreadful.
Yeah.
But a couple groups have written about some things that they're worried about. One is the PIRG, U.S. Public Interest Research Group. They have their 27th edition of Trouble in Toyland report, And they, in this report, they have all the laboratory testing for toys, which has lead, which has and other kinds of things. And so you can get to that from going to their website. And also, there is apparently Greenpeace now has released a report called Toxic Threads, the Big Fashion Stitch-Up. They looked at 141 clothing items and took a look between textile manufacturing facilities using hazardous chemicals and the presence of chemicals in their final products. So you might be lining up at the stores, but take a good look before you purchase.
In other words, some of your clothing might be filled with poisons.
That's right, because of how they maybe get the colors into clothing or, you know, how
do we
they
know,
clean
is there,
them.
We, at this point, we don't have any way of knowing, right?
No, but Greenpeace did release this report, and I think that
did they name brands?
Yeah, I think they did, actually. And they took a look at where these textile manufacturing facilities, where these clothes were made.
Were most of them made outside the United States?
You know, I have to confess I didn't look at the report.
Yeah, that's going to be a fascinating
you're
one.
You're a little bit beyond my knowledge basis
fine.
Here. Also, now this is something I've been involved in since Katrina, but it is interesting. Consumer Federation of America issued a report today saying that these people that homes were destroyed by fire. Remember, after the hurricane came, there became this fire, and they couldn't control it, and it just took 150 homes or whatever out. Well, what they're now
saying— You're talking about Hurricane Sandy?
Yes, in Breezy Point, New Jersey.
Right.
So now the insurance companies are doing their old two-step, as I call it, with this anti-concurrent causation. That is, in other words, if two things are happening at once. Now, there's another thing that, of course, this was a trick during Katrina, that they would say, well, yes, you have flood insurance, but you don't have mold insurance.
Oh, geez.
That was the Katrina trick.
Insurance companies are like the scum of the earth. You know, the old joke about banks used to be they never, you know, they always want you when you don't need them, and they and they won't talk to you when you do need them. Insurance companies are like that on steroids.
Well, and you know, my friend, I remember during Katrina, read the fine line and bought mold insurance. And so she was able to, but she was an attorney.
Right.
And most people don't buy mold insurance. And now they're having this anti-concurrent causation.
So if two things hit your house at once.
That's right.
You're uninsured.
That's, well, or at least you're not insured for the whole amount. That's for sure.
That's incredible.
And then, of course, FEMA can't come in until there's some settlement one way or the other with your insurance. It's the craziest set of laws. And hopefully people that didn't care much about Katrina, seeing that it happened in another part of the country, will begin to care now.
Yeah, yeah. Is there any discussion? When we lived in Vermont, there was a town that a river flooded, and it took out literally three houses floated down river. I mean, it washed out.
Right.
And so the town bought those lots and said, we're never going to let anybody build here. We're going to turn it into a public park. Is there any talk about doing that sort of thing with some of these areas that were destroyed in Hurricane Sandy?
You know, I haven't seen the plot plans yet. I mean, it did happen in Katrina. I just don't know.
Yeah, because there are, you know, clearly we've been building in areas we shouldn't be.
Yeah, to say the least.
Yeah, and the insurance isn't going
to
solve it.
And people ought not to be building some of those areas.
I agree. Yeah, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by free-don.org. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our third hour of our program. And with us in the studio, one of my heroes. I am continually talking about movement, activism, getting out there, getting active, doing something, tag your it, all that kind of stuff. And it all boils down to a couple of great organizations that are out there doing it. One of the best. Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org is their website. Get thee to that website and sign up, create, you know, participate. And Tim Carpenter, one of the co-founders or the co-founder of the group.
It works.
It works. Okay. Is here with us, the big cheese at PD America. Tim, great to have you in the studio.
Tom, thank you. It's an interesting day in Washington. I thought there was a fiscal crisis. I've been looking for Congress members all day in our nation's capital.
You've been running around the Capitol building?
We're knocking on doors. We're concerned. We have a deadline we have to meet here. We're out to protect Social Security and make sure we cut the military budget. And I think you're one of the few progressives still working at this late hour here in our nation's capital.
I think everybody's trying to get out of town, basically, for Thanksgiving. We're here, and we'll be here tomorrow as well. But Progressive Democrats of America, what are you guys up to right now?
Well, right now we're catching our breath. It was a week ago, as many people may remember, we were heading towards an election in which $6 billion was spent, over a billion of it in special interest money, and the progressive message, for the most part, was being dwarfed. We were very concerned about what the outcome was going to look like.
Tim, you need to pull the microphone a little
closer. So we're catching our breath in regards to the election. We're celebrating. A lot of folks didn't think we'd be celebrating too much coming into the election. But for Progressive Democrats of America, whether it be in the Senate, we're in Massachusetts, my hometown. We elected Elizabeth Warren, Tammy Baldwin out in Wisconsin. We're celebrating. And we're also celebrating the return of probably one of the most progressive, aggressive progressives, we'd like to say, Alan Grayson, out in Florida. So while we took 24 hours to celebrate, now we're back here at our nation's capital, lobbying, fighting, and making sure that the president gets out front now. We've been at his back. Now we need to get at his face. Today, specifically, is this whole question of the fiscal crisis.
Right. And what's your take on that?
Well, it's a false crisis. There is no crisis. I was with you 14 months ago. We can mark our calendars. It was the Cat Food Commission. It was Bull Simpsons. We have to cut Social Security. We have to cut Medicaid. We don't have a problem. We can't cut our way out of this. There's no austerity problem. We should be talking about prosperity. We should be talking about revenue generation. We should be talking about what needs to be done for middle-class America, more importantly, for working-class America, not another scheme to bail out Wall Street. So our whole premise is to remind the president, now that the election is behind us, to get out front and lead, just as progressives demanded FDR, protect Social Security, protect Medicare and Medicaid, and most importantly, our message today and for folks hopefully tomorrow to visit their members of Congress before they take off for Thanksgiving is to put the military budget on the table. We keep talking about putting Social Security on the table. It's time to put the military budget. So specifically today, that's what our mission was on the halls of Congress.
Yeah. So you and a group of volunteers, PD America, people who just...
PDA, not everybody can come to Washington, of course, so most folks are going to be visiting in their district offices. It's what we call a letter drop. Not everybody can come to Washington, but there was a core team of us on the floor today making the round. This past week, the Friends Committee on Legislation brought 300 activists into our nation's capital. But tomorrow, folks are encouraged to take
Friends Committee, is that associated with the Quakers?
Yes, it's their lobbying arm. It's their arm. The Friends Committee on Legislation, which is the political arm of the American Friends Service Committee. They were on the Hill with the message of, put the military budget in play. $1 million per soldier in Afghanistan at a time when we should be out. If we're really going to talk about getting this budget in line, let's talk about putting the military budget on. So today was knocking on those doors. The one member of Congress, not a surprise to many of us progressives, who was fighting the good fight today is Congressman Jim McGovern, second-ranking Democrat on the Rules Committee. We had a great meeting with him. We also met with Keith Ellison's team, the second, the co-director of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, to map out our strategy. Between now and the holidays in December, this super committee at some point is going to have to meet, and they're going to have to come up with some decisions.
Now, talk a little bit about the inside-outside strategy. Progressive Democrats of America is not an arm of the Democratic Party. You guys are completely independent of the Democratic Party, and yet you are working to not just get Democrats elected, progressive Democrats specifically.
Important distinction.
A very important distinction. But to push them like crazy. I mean, yeah, we've both pointed out in our own various ways over the years. You said, you know, we need to push President Obama. That politicians don't lead typically. What they do is if they see a parade that's big enough, they'll jump in front of it and hoist a flag and say, this is my parade. And so it's up to us to create the parade. How do you do that?
Well, PBA was founded in 2004, as you said, inside outside. What we mean by that is to work aggressively inside the Democratic Party, whether it be at your local level, just as the Tea Party's done. We're the left counterbalance for that. Run for your county central committees. Run for your state offices. Run at the local level. Be the voice of the progressive Democrats in your local community. Fight inside to move the party in the direction we need to do it. But we know it's not simply going to be done inside. PDA is part of a larger social movement. So when we say inside outside, we talk about working from the outside or street heat. Every great social movement, if we begin with Elizabeth Cady Stanton at Seneca Falls, 1848, the women's movement ended in front of the Washington Wilson's administration. And whether we talk about the anti-war movement, it was monks who self-immolated in front of Secretary of Defense McNamara's offices that began to move the anti-war movement. But it took Bill Abzug cutting off the purse strings in Congress. So we needed to connect the outside with the inside. And PDA is unique in that way, and that we believe by bringing the outside movement to the inside, we can bring about real change. So we're about electing movement folks, people like Elizabeth Warren, not career politicians, people that are going to get in there and really make a difference. So we're organized at the congressional level, working both inside and outside the party. We're the insurgency to transform the party.
So if I go to PD America, Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org, if I go to the website for Progressive Democrats of America, what kind, and I, you know, I have a little time or I have a little bit of money or I don't have much of either. What are the options that are presented to me?
Well, that's the important thing is to value time. If you have an hour or 2 hours, whatever it be, go to the website. If you're in Wisconsin, you'll find Robert Hansen, who's our organizer out there. You'll join him on the overpass in what we call the Light Brigade, taking simple messages rather than just carrying our banners during the day, going out at night in Paul Ryan's congressional district and challenging him.
In Paul Ryan's district?
In Paul Ryan's district. So that's what PDA members were doing right up until the election. Or if you go to Illinois, Bill Bianchi, who's our organizer out in Illinois, you'd be working with National Nurses United. Again, working inside and outside the party, you'd be working with them on what we call the financial transaction tax or the Robin Hood tax.
Right.
Each state has a unique agenda in which they're working or organized. If you go out to California, you'll be working with folks there that are currently working on election campaigns as well as on the climate issue. So going to the website, identifying who in your neighborhood is organized and be a part of that. Or if there isn't anything going on, more importantly, be that change. Be that person. Be that person in your neighborhood can do that. Not everybody can give a lot of time, but what little time, we want to value it. If you can't organize a group of people, you yourself take responsibility. Get on the phone. We have strategic calls every month on these specific issues of ending the occupation, single-payer health care. Whatever the issue is that motivates you, there's a community out there. It's our role, our responsibility, and our job to plug you in to be part of the larger movement.
Now, you've talked about a variety of issues, issue-based activism. And am I correct in assuming that you and others at the top of PDA didn't sit around and say, oh, this is what Illinois is going to do, that this is all bottom-up, that this is all grassroots?
We're really proud of that. Driven. We take it very seriously. We're a co-op. The people that put in the sweat equity do the work. If Chicago wants to move in a direction, they share with us, and we work with them cooperatively. All of the candidates that we worked for were endorsed initially at the local level. It was a local chapter that vetted those candidates and said to us, this is somebody we should endorse. So we're very much, we take it very seriously from the bottom up. As the national director of PDA, I go to my local chapter meetings. Everybody on the national staff is plugged into their local chapter. The strength of PDA is that grassroots work, plugged into your local community. So again, wherever you find yourself geographically and wherever the work takes you, you'll find activists working on whatever issue it might be.
Right. This is Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. One of the best, one of the most effective, actually, progressive organizations.
So.
I'm not just blowing smoke, Tim. You know the effect and impact that that all of the people who are working with you, all of the volunteers, all across this country are having. I believe that we're seeing it in our elections right now.
I'm very proud of, over the course of the last 8 years, to set out to accomplish what we've accomplished. We have a lot of work to do. We don't kid ourselves. But we have accomplished a great deal. The single-payer movement tonight is stronger than it was 4 years ago when the president threw us under the bus. The movement inside the Democratic Party to bring us back to our progressive roots is alive and stronger than it's ever been. We're celebrating today. Alan West, finally gone, out of Congress. Some of the worst teabaggers, Dan Lundgren, out in California, gone. That's the direct work of activists like ourselves working that are making that difference.
There you go. Tim Carpenter, Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. Check it out. Thank you, Tim.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more right after this 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. PDAmerica.org. Check it out. Yeah, just jump over that fiscal cliff. Should be no problem at all. There ain't no cliff. Come on, this whole thing, this manufactured crisis, this is disaster capitalism. Read Naomi Klein's book. This is all about disaster capitalism. Create a disaster and then figure out a way to profit off it. And that's what the Republicans are trying to do. And there's some good Democrats who are trying to prevent them from doing that, and some independents like Bernie Sanders. And we all need to, you know, speak up and have our voice out there and be a part of that. Big guy reports in our chat room, Mark Warner says he's not going to run for governor of Virginia. He's going to stay in the Senate. That's interesting. So step by step, things move along. Stuart in Seattle. Hey, Stuart, what's on your mind?
Yes, after your well-documented reports today of Republicans conspiring to use dirty tricks to take the presidency, I think it's clear to you and me that two or more powerful people regularly get together to plot to screw a lot of people, to gain a lot of power, that is, they conspire. Mm. Isn't it time to shoot people down when they dismiss an idea solely on the basis of calling something a conspiracy theory, or calling the person who proposed the idea a conspiracy nut? Take 9/11, for example. The only question is whether it was Osama bin Laden and his cohorts, or insiders in the U.S. government, or a combination of them both, that did the conspiracy. We all know it was conspiracy. We get told over and over, powerful people plotting to screw a lot of people to gain a lot of power. Oh, that's crazy. No, it's not crazy.
No, in fact, it's how it usually happens. I not disagree with you, Stuart, and marginalizing people who say things like, they were manipulating the voting machines, or maybe they, are in Ohio, not the voting machines, but the tabulation. Smart Tech, this company, the Republican-controlled company, founded by the former Republican National Committee Finance Chair. Smart Tech was the company in Chattanooga, Tennessee, that Ken Blackwell in the 2004 election had outsourced counting of the Ohio vote to, in the event the servers crashed in Ohio, which just by coincidence they did at 11:14 p.m. That night. It must be a conspiracy nut. Yeah, who would talk about that? Darren in Levittown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Darren, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. With all this talk – oh, by the way, there's a website, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a member of it, and I'm
okay.
A proud member of that.
Okay.
For all those who use the statement conspiracy nut, if there's no such thing as conspiracy, then why, pray tell, is it against the law?
You can conspire to jaywalk, and the jaywalking is a misdemeanor, but the conspiracy to jaywalk in many states is a felony.
Yeah. Here's something I'd like to ask you and your listeners. There is a book by David Rockefeller, and it's called Memoirs. It was written back in like 2002, 2004, somewhere around there. And I'm not going to read the whole quote, but I will paraphrase very quickly so that you can comment on it. David talks about how, many people have accused him and his family and his family's friends of being part of a secret cabal, and that they were part of an American political and that they wielded inordinate influence over the American political and social economic institutions.
Right.
And he says his last line is, if that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I'm proud of it. Now, this comes from David Rockefeller's own
I think
book,
Ted Kennedy would have said the same thing. Hello?
Hello, I'm done.
Yeah, I think Ted Kennedy would have said the same thing. I mean, there are people who by virtue of birth end up in dynastic positions and use that to go into politics and think that what they're doing is for the best, whether it's David Rockefeller or Jeb Bush or George W. Bush or Ted Kennedy and his brothers John and Robert.
It's rather interesting in this quote.
What is new in that?
He says that he's part of an internationalist group. And the word here, it's a biblical reference, cabal, a secret cabal.
Yeah.
And
I don't find that exceptional, Darren. I don't find that surprising that he would say that. I don't know the larger context, but and I'm not one of those who is convinced that the Rockefellers are out to get us. But the fact of the matter is that there is a group of very wealthy people who basically, do run much of America. They do it by virtue of their corporate power, their political power. Citizens United gave them even more power. And that's not how a democracy should be run. We shouldn't be a plutocracy. We shouldn't be an aristocracy. We shouldn't be an oligarchy. We should be a democratic
George
republic.
Washington actually talked about it, and he used the word Illuminati in one of his texts.
Yeah.
And, in describing, because he was getting messages from his people over in Europe.
Right.
And they were talking about how the Illuminati was actually spreading through Europe and that it was beginning to take hold in America.
But George Washington was a Mason. His inauguration ceremony included a Masonic parade. There are woodcuts of it. You can see over at the National Archives of all the various Masonic chapters turning out and carrying their flags. And Washington was a high-order Mason. Does that mean that it's all conspiracy stuff, that the Masons controlled America? There's a lot of Masonic symbolism here in this city, in D.C. It's incredible, actually. And a lot of it got adopted by the Mormons. You know, Joseph Smith ripped off a lot of Masonic stuff and built it into Mormonism.
Right down to
temple underwear and sacred numbers and symbols.
There's a great movie out for you and your listeners and watchers. If you haven't seen it already, it was nominated for an Emmy, and it's called Hacking Democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And they go to the election board in Daytona. Now, I lived in Daytona for, I guess, about a year in total, and I can tell you the police there are thugs.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Darren, thanks a lot for the call. 27 minutes past the hour. Is it wrong to suggest that...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Let me be more specific. Was Lyndon Johnson wrong when he suggested that if the American people knew that Richard Nixon was a traitor, they would be shocked? The good, the bad, and the very, very parentarily ugly, the good. Newark, New Jersey Mayor Cory Booker, after a weekend Twitter spat with a Tea Partier over the role of government in providing nutrition to its citizens, Booker proposed a challenge to his Twitter troll. He proposed that they both try to live on food stamps in New Jersey and try to feed their families for 1 week just to see how hard it really is. Today, Mayor Booker said he's more than willing to do it if his challenge is accepted. Post-election, the right has continued to demonize the poor as lazy and irresponsible and blame President Obama's re-election on people voting to receive gifts. It's time for people to see the true reality of poverty in America, which is a constant, desperate struggle. Well done, Mayor Booker, for bringing attention to it. The bad. Marco Rubio. During an interview with GQ magazine, the early frontrunner for Republicans in 2016 was asked the question, "How old do you think the Earth is?" Rubio responded to the question saying, "I'm not a scientist, man. At the end of the day, I think there are multiple theories out there on how the universe was created, and I think this is a country where people should have the opportunity to teach them all. Whether the Earth was created in 7 days or seven actual eras, I'm not sure we'll be able to answer that. It's one of the great mysteries," end of quote. Actually, according to real scientists, the Earth's age is somewhere around 4.5 billion years. Rubio, like the rest of his party, is at odds with science and facts in general. And the very, very ugly Rush Limbaugh. As usual, Limbaugh used his radio show on Monday to demonize the unemployed in America. He reported on how various organizations are calling on lawmakers to extend unemployment benefits, which are set to expire at the end of the year, leaving 2.1 million Americans without the financial assistance they need to survive. What was Limbaugh's reaction to this? To break into the song singing, "Here Comes Santa Claus, Here Comes Santa Claus." Right. Because unemployment benefits and food stamps are gifts. I wonder what Limbaugh would call the billions in subsidies to oil companies, the billions in no-bid contracts to defense corporations, and the trillions in tax breaks for rich guys like himself. Those are the real gifts. While protection from sickness, hunger, and unemployment should be basic rights in America. Once again, Rush Limbaugh is very, very ugly. There's really no other way to describe it, you know. There really isn't. Ed in Seattle. Hey, Ed, it says you disagree with me. What's this?
Well, hi, Tom.
What's up?
Just ever so slightly. And
it's quite all right. I mean, I put people at the front of the line who disagree with me.
Well,
the topic.
This is the I'm Ed Mays, the pirate TV guy. And you bought me dinner once, like back in 2002.
Uh-huh.
And I told you that that I was a Green, but I was in the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her the reason why, and it's because, you know, the progressives need to take over the Democratic Party. That's how social progress usually happens.
I agree, and that's what Progressive Democrats of America are working on.
Yeah. So that's just to say that I'm not partisan. But the thing is, it's a little bit misleading to say, you know, that the Democrats, you know, don't want to talk about the election theft because, you know, it will, they're afraid that it will blow the credibility of the election. Well, that's true, but, you know, I think it's actually because they have a tacit agreement that they don't go there.
I don't think so. And I genuinely think, you know, and I've talked to a number of people about this, a couple of elected Democrats, mostly Democratic strategists in this town, and you raise the issue of voter integrity, of the, you know, why are we one of the few countries in the world that has privatized our elections to private corporations? And why do we allow partisan officials to run elections in states? And they're like, oh, let's not get into this conspiracy nonsense. And I'm like, this is not conspiracy nonsense. These are the changes that have happened really just in the last 15 years. I mean, George Bush really put this on steroids in 2002 with the Help America Vote Act, where Congress gave $4.5 billion to the states to buy machines from Republican-run companies. And I think that Democrats are afraid to talk about it because they're afraid that if people think that the machines are rigged, they won't show up to vote. Now, I'm not saying that the machines are rigged. I mean, they might be working perfectly. There's a million other things happening in the background. But whatever it may be, we shouldn't have privatized voting systems, and we need to be exposing this stuff. Where, again, Ed, are you and I disagreeing?
You know, it's because the Democrats do it, too. That's what the agreement is.
Okay. See, I disagree. I don't think that the Democrats are involved in voter suppression, and I don't think that the Democrats are involved in...
They're not involved in... steal elections, you know, and...
How do the Democrats steal elections, Ed?
Well, you know, you wrote books about this. You know, you know, everybody...
Well, I can tell you the Democrats were engaged in ballot stuffing back in the 20s and 30s when they were the party of segregation. But ever since the Lyndon Johnson era, ever since, you know, down in the South, the Democrats down in the South who used to be the old Dixiecrats, you know, the racist white Southerners, you know, Nixon picked them all up in the early 70s and late 60s and early 70s, and they're all Republicans now.
I know.
So I don't see the Democrats, you know, stealing elections or stuffing ballots.
They stole the Kennedy election.
No, they didn't.
You know?
No, they didn't.
The Democrats did.
No. That was a story that was made up by Republicans that Mayor Daley had his machine and literally physical voting machines, the vote for Kennedy, and later he dumped them in the river and all this stuff. It's an entire vanishing hitchhiker story. It's an entire myth. And not only that, if Kennedy had lost Illinois, he still would have won the presidency. So, you know, it's just, I mean, it's like you're buying Republican propaganda, Ed. I recommend not doing that. It'll give you indigestion. Dorothy in Foothills Ranch, California. Hey, Dorothy, what's on your mind today? Dorothy? Dorothy, three tries, you're out. Rick in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Rick, thanks for listening to Minnesota's Progressive Voice, AM 950. What's up? Rick?
Yes.
You're on the air, sir.
Okay.
Please pick up your phone.
Yep.
Okay. What's your question?
I want to make sure that everybody knows about the benefits of algae oil.
Okay.
The best alternative to renewable biofuel.
All right. I've heard about this. In fact, a friend of mine made a movie about a guy down in Texas who was growing algae, turned it into a little mini industry. It's a growing business, and making biofuel out of it. So, yeah, I don't disagree with you. I think it's a good idea. Angela in Waco, Texas. Hey, Angela, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom.
Hi, Angela.
Yes, I just wanted to, in reference to the subject matter you were discussing earlier about some of the treasonous acts that the Republicans have used to steal elections, one of the comments that I wanted to make is concerning the election of 2004. During that time, they had the threat levels, the color threat levels that they used whenever there was a threat that came on, or, you know, heightened threat. And it seemed to me that during that time, the closer the election got, the higher the threat level went,
yeah.
Which I think that was a huge influence on the election.
I agree. Was it Tommy Thompson who was the who's the Secretary of Homeland Security in 2004? Oh, Tom Ridge. That's right, Tom Ridge. And it was Tom Ridge who went on, I believe it was the David Letterman show after the election, and said, and David Letterman asked him, why is it that we kept getting these, you know, red alerts every time John Kerry started getting some good publicity? And Tom Ridge said, I don't know, I'd get these orders from the White House. He just came right out and said it. So, yes, the fact of the matter is, Angela, that national security threats were being used by the Bush administration to manipulate voters to make Americans more frightened so that they would vote to reelect George Bush, which, in my opinion, they didn't do anyway. But, according to the official count coming out of the voting tabulators in Ohio, routed through Smartex tabulators in Chattanooga, Tennessee, Bush did win. So that's the end of that. Angela, thanks for the call. Tim in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm very progressive Democrat. Appreciate that website.
But I know there's a butt coming.
No, there's not a butt coming. No.
Oh, okay.
My worry is I want Democrats to maintain momentum, which is something they didn't do in 2008, and then they got clobbered in 2010.
Right. We all went to sleep. Not we all, but much of the electorate figured, okay, Obama's got this. We can just kind of go back to rock and roll and wiffle ball or something.
Right. Well, Nate Silver has got an article. It was written on the 16th, a few days ago. It's the second most second most current article he's got on his 538 blog.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes into a lot of anecdotal, statistical, and, demographic evidence that shows that, Democrats really almost have to stay in, they're going to have to do some research and maintain some kind of substantial effort, on an ongoing basis right up until 2014, really, to have a shot at it.
I agree. In large part because of gerrymandering, because of the redistricting that was done in a half dozen Republican controlled states after the 2010 census.
Bring that up, which I thought about that. But he also does bring up a lot of, historical, anecdotal things.
Yeah, but here's one simple fact. The Democrats in the House of Representatives received 500,000 more votes than Republicans in the House of Representatives nationwide. So shouldn't there be a Democratic majority in the House of Representatives? There isn't because of gerrymandering, because of these districts that were created by the Republicans in these states to create safe Republican districts. And that's wrong. It's just simply wrong. We need to fix that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And frankly, that's probably a constitutional fix. It's probably going to require a constitutional amendment that simply says the congressional districts shall be, polygons or something.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Welcome back. Ode to Tom over on our message boards. Interesting. Steve in Longport, New Jersey. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, thanks for taking the call. I'm a progressive, and I guess my concern is that I'm with the party. I understand the tax increases, but I guess my concern is Obama deferred the first couple years of the Bush-era tax cut, and the reason he did that was why?
So that Republicans would not take long-term unemployment benefits from 99 weeks down to zero. They compromised with them and extended them for 74 weeks. And in exchange for that, he extended the Bush tax cuts for 2 years.
So it didn't have to do with the economy and the state of the economy.
No.
It was to maybe to
no. It had to do with keeping unemployment benefits going to people who were about to be thrown out of their homes.
Okay.
The Republicans were quite happy to throw those people out of their homes. And Obama said, okay, if tax cuts are the price of it, we'll do it.
Okay, and now what we have is, here's the thing that bothers me. I'm a progressive, and I understand we're in a regressive tax rate, but I think what people really don't understand is that, the top 1% pay 37% of the taxes. The top 10 pay 60%.
And
the top, let me just pause you for a second here, Steve. The five members of the Walton family who inherited Sam Walton's money own more wealth. Those five people own more wealth than the bottom 41% of America. Now, you know, they may be paying, they and you know, 30,000 or 300,000 other top 1% may be paying 37% of the taxes, but they sure as hell own a lot more than 37% of this country.
But why should we hate on someone who is successful? It's like...
I am not hating on anyone, Steve.
No, I'm not saying you. I'm with you. But what I'm saying is, I think...
No, you're not. You're parroting Republican talking points and calling yourself a progressive.
No.
Steve, just simply consider this simple fact, Steve. The average working person is paying payroll taxes on their first 10, 20,000, still below the poverty level. They're paying payroll taxes on every single penny of their income, Social Security taxes.
What are they paying? What's their income tax rate?
Which, you know, you're talking federal income tax? Or you want to talk the federal?
No, I know their payroll taxes because they have a job.
They're paying payroll taxes. They are paying sales taxes. They are paying property taxes. They are paying all these kind of taxes. The fact of the matter is that working people in the United States who earn less than, Steve, I'm going to put you on hold here for a minute so I can finish what I'm saying. Working people in the United States who earn less than $30,000 a year are paying more as a percentage of their income in taxes than are the top 1%. It's very simple. It is a fact. You can look it up. Back to you, Steve.
Do this.
You're back on the air.
Wait, Tom?
Yes.
What do you make a year?
It's none of your damn business, Steve. I love it when these guys go, I'm a progressive. Let's. Victor in Norfolk, Virginia. Hey, Victor, what's on your mind today?
Hey, the truth will set you free, won't it?
Depends.
Anyway, look, this is what I want to ask, right?
Mm-hmm.
We know that at the end of President Obama's term, right?
Yeah.
We probably, hello, are we still there?
You're still here?
Yeah. We know that we probably aren't going to have a black candidate or somebody black running in the general. Probably going to be two white candidates. Now, how are the Republicans are going to bring the Hispanics and the African American community in to vote for them when you have two white groups, right? That means that because you got two white groups, the white votes is probably going to be divided between those two.
Victor,
and all you got left.
What's your point?
My point is that I think that's the biggest fear of the Republicans.
Oh, what will they do when they can't use racism anymore?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, well, what they'll do what they're doing right now. They'll start losing elections. Victor, good point. Thank you very much. Richard in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hello. So let me putting off my speaker. There I am. I was calling about earlier. You talked about Kissinger and with somebody about his derailing the peace talks.
Right.
And I read about this about 30 years ago. Seymour Hersh, his book. Nixon, Kissinger, the White House years went into a great deal of depth.
Uh-huh. Now, we're talking about in 68, in the election of 68.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, right. But his book is pretty well footnoted, and he did talk about it. Kissinger was helping the Democrats and Republicans, told somebody in South Vietnam they'd get a better deal to hold off on the peace accords. 7 years later, 50,000 dead. They got the same deal that had been arranged by
That's very interesting.
So it's in Seymour Hersh's book. I read it about 25 years ago. Also, your discussion about kinds of things that the Republicans have done with these elections, I didn't get to hear all of it. Love to see an article written for, like, maybe The Nation magazine going into what you were talking about, because I think these people these people have been getting away with this stuff.
Yeah.
And
Sam and I have been putting this stuff together and posting it over at truthout.org. You can find the last couple of days' worth of it over there, complete with links. Yeah. Oh,
one other thing, too, if I could, about the other one. Your show is always fascinating. About the daily stealing the election. There was a program on in Chicago recently that a far more important election result in this state at that time during the Kennedy election was the state's attorney, probably more important to Daley and his machine.
Yeah.
And when they, his man won, but not by any great margin. So if he was like puppet master, he sure didn't do it for himself then.
Yeah, no, that was my point. The election of 1960 was not stolen in Chicago. In fact, as I said, Kennedy didn't even need Illinois. Coming up next, tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program, the day before Thanksgiving, anything goes. You choose the topics, dial me up wherever you happen to be, work, home, car, bus, on the way to Grandma's house. Plus, we'll have the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for We the People. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires your action. Go to pdamerica.org and sign up. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.